Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Instagram or Threads at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. If you're looking for a bit of extra help on learning your orchestra or solo repertoire, perhaps we can help. Visit www.thecellosherpa.com and drop us a line. We offer virtual or in-person lessons. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Today's guest is cellist Stephen Doan, who is internationally acclaimed as a soloist, chamber musician, and teacher. He has been professor of cello at the Eastman School of Music for the past 42 years and has also served as a visiting professor at the Royal College of Music in London. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Thanks, Joel. It's a pleasure to be here.
So in 1974, your friends dared you to enter the Tchaikovsky competition, and you made it all the way to the finals. Can you talk about how that decision shaped your career?
Well, I think at the time that I was doing it, it definitely gave me a focus. And I was in grad school and I probably needed a project. And it was great to have that support from my colleagues. But the experience was amazing because I had been intending to go to Russia to study with Rostropovich, but he had just defected. And I had even started studying Russian a little bit as a grad student at Stony Brook. I'd been given a grant from the Watson Foundation to do overseas study, and I postponed it a bit to get my master's degree with Bernie Greenhouse. And I asked Bernie if I could apply to the Tchaikovsky competition, and he said yes, and I went ahead and did so, and then decided maybe that wasn't such a great idea. And then certain folks told me I should go ahead and try. So it was a great exercise in learning a lot of music and going into a pressurized situation. And fascinating to meet the other players, both the Americans and the Russians that were there. What I did strategically wrong was I didn't really think I'd make it to the finals. So I concentrated on the first two rounds.
Oh.
When I got to the finals, I kind of couldn't believe what was happening. But it was still a big thrill. It was fun to do it.
So was the repertoire different in the finals than you had played in the previous rounds?
Yeah, the first two rounds were both different repertoire. The first two rounds were solo and sonata music. And the last round was the Tchaikovsky Rococo and the Dvorak back-to-back with orchestra, televised with a glass of water in between. And that was quite something. Anyway, I just loved that orchestra. They played so beautifully.
Wow. What was that like, though, to try and play those two pieces back-to-back like that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was interesting. It was a little bit of a, I guess it feels like a little bit of a cello decathlon, but I'd been playing them for a number of years. So it was something I was, you know, we were all supposed to be able to do that.
Yeah.
So what I just found when I was playing both pieces was I want to play chamber music with these wind players because there was such great playing going on behind me. I was like, oh my heavens, these guys are extraordinary musicians. And I don't know what my part sounded like, but I sure enjoyed the experience. Yeah.
Well, and so talk a little bit about, you said you wanted to go study with Rostropovich. Was that something that you had in the works and then he defected, or was that sort of your aspiration?
I had written a proposal. The Thomas J. Watson Foundation is based in Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, and it was funded by the founder of IBM, or the son of the founder of IBM, I think. And they give grants for people to study all kinds of different subjects. They do interviews at small colleges throughout the U.S. I was studying at Oberlin College, and they came around, and I was determined to go and study cello pedagogy in Europe and hopefully in Russia at that point.
Yeah.
I wanted to meet various people who I'd only heard on recordings, like Tortelier and Fournier and Starker, who I just met once or twice. So I ended up going over and playing in a lengthy masterclass series to Starker. I met Tortelier. Well, there's some stories attached to that experience. But at the time the Tchaikovsky thing popped up, I was in my first year of master's work at Stony Brook. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just do this. It was exciting. And the strangest thing, when we toured the conservatory. Guidon Kremer gave us a tour around the building.
Oh, cool.
And there was a picture of the jury at the 1972 or the 1970 Tchaikovsky competition. And you could see this little bald head in the middle of the judges. And he pointed to that person's head and he said, "That's the biggest picture of Rostropovich you will find in the conservatory." It kind of winked at us. That was his way of explaining that Slava was sort of officially in disgrace because he'd left.
Yeah.
Obviously, he had huge respect for him. So I didn't meet Chefrin, but Chefrin was chairing the jury, and Maurice Marécal, the French cellist, was there, and Leonard Rose was there. I met Leonard in between rounds. He actually spoke to me very kindly.
Yeah.
And I'd known about him, but I'd never actually met him. My teacher was good friends with him and had studied with him.
Yeah.
And he was very sweet to me, but it was a very quick encounter. "Young man, I shouldn't be speaking to you like this." It was kind of cute.
Did you ever get the chance to study with Rostropovich?
No, I played a couple of recording sessions. I was guest principal with the London Symphony Orchestra about 20 years ago, and he was recording some new concertos that had been written for him. So I was sitting 10 feet from him. So we got to chat to each other a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's an extraordinary phenomenon.
Yeah.
A big bear of a man. It was nice to finally meet him. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think he influenced so many of us. Mm. Yeah. So let's talk about that then. You had brief stints as principal cellist of the Milwaukee Symphony and then the Rochester Philharmonic. So what were those experiences like? And what was the reason you didn't continue down the orchestral career path, having had those two positions?
Well, the appointment in Milwaukee came after I'd been overseas studying with Stephen Issel's teacher. And she just helped me enormously. And I can tell you a bit more about that. But my folks started sending me clippings from the Musicians Union newspaper, of course, in print. This is way before any of this stuff we do now. And said, "Dear, you're going to run out of money," because I had a grant that would last me about a year for my overseas study.
Yeah.
And they said, "We'll help you with a plane fare from where we lived in Michigan to Milwaukee to take an audition." And I guess I had beginner's luck, you could call it. I just went and they offered me the job, and I was very happily surprised and pleased to have employment. A lovely orchestra, wonderful colleagues. And my stand partner, Lauren Brown, eventually became the principal and has been in the Chicago Symphony for years afterwards. But it was a wonderful experience to be in that group. And partway through that year, Emmanuel Ax came through town and at a rehearsal with us said, "Guys, let's play some chamber music this evening. I've been playing on the road. I want to play chamber music." So we had a chamber evening with him at somebody's house with a good piano.
Nice.
And I realized I missed that terribly. I'd been at Marlborough, and that was a passion of mine. And the pianist of the New Arts Trio approached me because they were having a personnel change. And I joined that group. And the school that the trio was in residence at, the Wisconsin Conservatory, was determined I should just be in the trio. I couldn't juggle the symphony and the trio.
Oh, okay.
And so I was sort of forced to make it difficult. So I would have definitely enjoyed staying with the orchestra and rehearsing trios, but I think it was more than they wanted me to be doing.
Yeah.
So the trio got very intense. We rehearsed and taught there at the Wisconsin Conservatory for 4 years. And in the last year we were doing that, we won the Naumburg Award.
Oh, wow.
And started getting some touring opportunities, quite a few of them actually. And at that point, the pianist got a job at Eastman.
Oh.
And the Rochester Philharmonic principal cellist slot came up. And I thought, well, Piotr Yanovsky, the violinist, a wonderful violinist, he sadly passed away. Anyway, we both knew we needed to get out east. We couldn't stay in Milwaukee if we were going to keep the trio together.
Yeah.
I ended up in Rochester. And I had a wonderful boss. David Zinman was our music director.
Right.
That was two amazing years of listening to an orchestra be really held to account by a great musician. It was fantastic experience, and wonderful colleagues here too.
Yeah. And then at that point, I guess when you were principal of Rochester, is that when you started teaching part-time at Eastman?
Yes. They hired me to teach some orchestral repertoire and a few students on Mondays.
Okay.
I had a sort of a mini cello class, maybe five students and some orchestral rep. And then I discovered I was really enjoying that. I had been teaching chamber music and cello in Milwaukee, and that was a lot of fun. And a couple of those people came along to Rochester, followed us out here. And there's some very excellent players. Mark Stewart was in that class, and he's now a famous crossover guy. He plays amazing cello and guitar, and you name it. everything.
Yeah.
I found the teaching fascinating partly because of the work I'd done during my Watson Foundation year that followed the Tchaikovsky thing. I can tell you a little bit about that if that's useful.
Sure.
When I was doing the year with the Watson Foundation grant, the first stop was Luzern, Switzerland, where Janusz Starker was doing a 3-week masterclass. And I dived into that situation and ended up playing for him rather frequently in the classes. And it was a little bit like getting struck by lightning every 3 minutes, but it was also very, very informative. Watching him teach the other pupils, it was easier for me to take on board the information because I was less under the gun.
Yeah.
But I could see that there was this incredible system, and the way his thoughts were organized about string playing was absolutely mind-boggling to me.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, yeah, I was gradually accumulating a big shopping list of stuff I needed to continue exploring. You know how one gets through a degree process? I'd gotten through the master's degree, and I had this curious feeling that one has this feeling that I'm not cooked yet.
Uh-huh. You're not ready.
Or yeah, there's stuff that needs to be explored. And I was a very lucky fellow because I had this grant. So I had the classes with Starker, and then I was in Geneva for a bit. I went to Bristol, England for the Imperial Tobacco Cello Competition, which was chaired by Paul Tortelier.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And when I got there, I met a floppy 16-year-old cellist named Stephen Isterlis and his good friend David Waterman, and who became the cellist to the Endelian Quartet, a wonderful musician. And we got to be friends. And Stephen and I got chucked out after the semifinals. And Tortelier was a very theatrical man. So he made speeches in the jury room after the second round or the semifinal round. And he told him he played like an old man. He said, "I tell you to play louder and faster. What happened? You play slower and softer." and then he declared me a tragedy. I basically, you could be a great cellist, but you have this problem with your bow arm. You know, he was going on about that. So, and I knew I was in some trouble. I was having some issues with my bowing. So the next stop was London. I was supposed to go play to Bill Pleath. And I had a letter from his wife, but fortunately, Stephen's family took me in for a while and encouraged me to go to his teacher, Jane Cowan.
Yeah.
And from knowing Stephen and watching the way he played, I could tell there was something really unusual going on. And as I later told somebody, he was breaking all the rules as I knew them, but it was certainly working.
Yeah.
So I was a very lucky fellow because I got to work with Jane over the next 9 months or so. Mm-hmm. She was at the International Cello Center in London in Ladbroke Grove, but then she'd moved the school up to Scotland where her husband's family had an ancestral home. And we were all in this big old Scottish hunting lodge with a wonderful music room, practicing and having lessons and just really away from it all. And I got a whole new bow arm and a whole different perspective on music making from an incredible musician. She was a student of Feuermann. Mm-hmm. She'd grown up in Edinburgh. She'd met Casals when she was 13. And she'd grown up going to Donald Tovey, the great musicologist, all of his lectures at the university there. Mm-hmm. And she was a very unusual person. I mean, she's one of the first real geniuses I ever met.
Yeah.
Some of the most fun experiences were watching Stephen's lessons with her. Sometimes I was playing the piano for him because I got this deputized because that was my first instrument. It was not in school, but it was a very concentrated musical environment.
Yeah, Stephen Isterlis was actually our very first interview on this podcast.
I'll be darned.
Back in March of 2021.
No kidding.
So would you say that this experience is what kind of lit that fire for you that you wanted to focus more on teaching while obviously doing lots of performing, that you would hone in on that?
Well, it didn't happen all of a sudden. I was obviously fascinated by Jane's work, and I kept going back every year for the next, I don't know, until I was in my early 30s, I was going back every spring for lessons. But her methods were so different and so interesting to me that I found myself, at first I thought it was just me that she was helping. And then I realized when I was teaching that I was referring back to her methods and the principles, that the principles she was teaching were universally applicable. Mm-hmm. And that was, what would you call it? Big news. I was very intrigued with that. And so possibly that it made me realize I was part of, I guess you call it passing it forward.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was part of a process that had helped me and seemed to be helping my pupils. And that's how it started. What I found really fun was that performing and teaching were kind of a loop. that I learned from teaching, but I also learned from performing how the things we were talking about in lessons applied. Mm-hmm. I think any teacher that's really interested in teaching in a deep way is also learning the whole time. And you're adding to your own musical vocabulary as you're working. So yeah, it's fascinating. I think it's a kind of an energy loop.
Yeah. Well, is there a way you could describe your teaching philosophy?
Well, when I was first teaching, I thought it was a bit daunting coming to Eastman because it's a, you know, a very high level school.
Yeah.
And I was teaching just a few pupils, but I thought, well, if I'm supporting them and giving them encouragement and also giving them some information, it can't be all wrong. Mm-hmm. Then you realize that it's a dialogue. You have to come to consensus about what the student feels they need and what you can see that they need or what you perceive they need. And when you can come to a sense of that together, you can do a lot.
Yeah.
And you don't have to have all the answers, but I guess we all have to be open to exploring different solutions. I call it, sometimes I'll say, look, this is a hypothetical solution. Let's see where it takes us. But I guess the main thing is both my wife and I, because we teach collaboratively, we're very interested in trying to bring out the person's musical voice.
Okay.
And somebody can be a wonderful cellist, but we need to say something when we play. And part of the job is to help them build a technique that's so natural that Jane used to call it the transcendental technique. You want to build a way of playing the instrument that doesn't seem like anything other than a really natural process.
Yeah.
And that's the idea that the music making should flow out of how your relationship with the instrument works. And also that your imagination should be unfettered musically if possible.
Yeah.
And that you can think beyond the cello. And Stephen does a lot of score study at the piano, and that's something we encourage. And we all have to think. So you have the big picture of music making and then the obvious necessity of mastering an instrument.
So what do you look for then in a potential student?
I think the most important thing is you've got to feel a musical intention coming from the person that's playing. Mm-hmm. They've got to play the instrument relatively well, but nobody's perfect, especially as an undergrad. Most of us are still forming.
Yeah.
So you're looking for a certain instrumental talent, but we're also especially looking for a musical message to be coming across. Mm-hmm. When you're listening to somebody and you find you're just listening and that they're engaging you musically, that's an extraordinarily good side.
So even if they're struggling on the technical side, but they're giving you something, so they have some voice, that's more appealing than the perfection of technique?
Well, sometimes they all have both, which is amazing. but most of us at that point have some gaps. And one can teach technique because there are lots of ways of explaining things and building up somebody's fluency. But there's got to be something coming from the person. That's the thing you can't teach is what we're looking for.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Don't you think?
Yeah, because it's very hard to teach somebody to be musical.
You can talk about principles. It's very hard to describe, but you're looking for a musician.
Yeah. Well, then on the flip side of that, what do you think a student should be looking for in a potential teacher when they take a trial lesson?
That's a good question. I think you have to have a sense of comfort with the individual. Mm-hmm. And if it's a conversation, I think that's really important.
Yeah.
I played to somebody once and that was a fine cellist, but they talked at me and I went out of that session. This is pre-college. I went out of that session sort of scratching my head. I didn't feel that we really had interacted. Mm-hmm. I guess when you're playing to a prospective teacher that you want to find out whether, if there's a conversation going on, whether your concerns are being possibly either intuited or asked about. I know in master classes, sometimes I'll just say, look, what do you like best about playing this piece? And then what are your challenges? Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in both.
Yeah.
So trial lessons are tricky. I want to see if the person responds and whether we have fun.
Yeah. Well, so then do you encourage, because it's so hard if you have, let's say, 100 students come through an audition, to have no idea what any of those students would be like to teach. Do you encourage people to come ahead of time and take a trial lesson with you, or after they know they might be in your studio to help them make a decision? How do you maneuver that with potential students?
A lot of them will ask. That's sometimes really helpful, mm-hmm. even if it's on Zoom sometimes.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's time consuming. It's nice to know a little bit about them ahead of time if you can, but sometimes you just don't. We're meeting for the first time and you're trying to get an impression. And sometimes I'll go back down the same evening and listen to people and just say, well, let's spend 15, 20 minutes trying some stuff. And the audition weekends can get a little crazy that way.
Oh, I imagine. But I would think that since the pandemic, that one of the silver linings is that Zoom has become more acceptable. So if somebody wasn't able to come to you ahead of the audition, or there wasn't time right. during the audition, you could at least have some sort of collaboration.
Yes. Sometimes Zoom is a great follow-up.
Yeah.
Yeah. It can be a really useful follow-up. And it is surprisingly, I was one of the last of the Luddites. I didn't want to do any of this online stuff.
Yeah.
So I was kind of amazed during COVID how much we were able to get done
yeah.
on Zoom. I went into school once a week for the studio classes because we could be in a large space.
Oh, okay.
And we could be socially distant.
Yeah.
But I couldn't believe we'd get into the big room and I'd realize half of the cellos were out of adjustment or people were playing to their imaginary microphone 2 feet in front of them. And so we were talking a lot about opening up into the space and thinking about being out of your own bedroom again.
Yeah, you know? That's true. That's a tough time.
Oh, it was difficult. Oh my gosh. I just hand it to the students that made it through that.
Yeah.
Our students were incredible. And they put up with the fact that we weren't there in person, you know, that we had to do a lot of online stuff. But that was a very touching experience to go through with them. Also, what was fascinating about Zoom was I would hear them play and we'd chat. And then I'd say, okay, I think I hear this. Mm-hmm. And what do you hear at your end? And what are you feeling?
Yeah.
And they started doing the most amazing self-diagnosis. That was so nice because like, well, my left hand's a little heavy or I'm feeling thus and such going on. And so it seemed like we needed their feedback, don't you think, more than ever when we were doing that?
Definitely. Definitely. That's a great way to put it.
It was really tricky because you're only getting part of the picture online.
Yeah. I mean, I made all my students buy USB mics. Just like a $30 mic, because then at least you weren't getting cancellations of the highs and lows, and it was really difficult. But it has helped because I'm usually not in town over the summer, so I'm able to teach my students still over the summer that want lessons. And then obviously I've met other people around the country that I've had a chance to do some coachings with on excerpts and things, which again, it's not the same as being in the same room, but you can accomplish quite a bit. So it's better than nothing, I think.
Yes, it certainly was. And I think I learned a great deal about the whole process of teaching through Zoom. Mm-hmm. It was intriguing. Yeah. Also, sometimes you could see their reaction a little more. Well, with my visual issues, I could see their reaction a little bit more closely sometimes on the monitor.
Oh, yeah.
If I did something they liked, I could see them light up. Or if I asked them a question that really engaged them, and that was coming through. Or if they had an idea they were really excited about, that was pretty hard to ignore too. So that monitor was a good friend.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what advice would you offer to high school students to help them prepare for and play their best college audition?
Oh my gosh. Well, okay. First thing, you're giving us a little concert.
Okay.
It's your time. It's your 15 minutes in that room and you're in charge. So we're there to listen. The next thing is, don't play the hardest piece you've ever played to try to impress us. Play the thing you love and that you know you play really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, there aren't certain pieces that we have to all hear. Play something you play really well and at the top level that you're capable of. Because a lot of people will play their reach piece in an audition and you realize, oh my God, it's just slightly beyond them. And as a result, you're not hearing what they could do musically, maybe, because the technical struggle is getting in the way sometimes.
Yeah.
So that's just an instance, but sometimes that happens. Yeah, I think it's important. And the teachers probably should know that the quality of the work is paramount, and they've got to have comfort with the pieces they're playing.
Yeah, that's great advice.
As much as they can.
So true. We've talked about that a lot on this podcast. Don't pick the sixth suite of Bach and Dvorak cello concerto and everything that's really, really the hardest that you can find.
Yeah, I mean, we've all going to have the rest of our lives to play Dvorak concerto, you know, and some people do it just fine. And that's great. But that's the thing. If you want to hear the musician.
Yeah.
You don't want to hear the cellist climbing Mount Everest.
Right. So true. Such wise words. So how much performing are you doing these days outside of teaching?
Well, I'm trying to keep some chamber music and recitals going, and that's great fun. I was in Michigan recently to do a recital, and a couple of former pupils got together. We did a concert that was built around some cello ensemble stuff, too. Mm-hmm. So there was a recital plus that. That was a blast. And I'm going to be playing Brahms double pretty soon here at Eastman, and some, I think, Schubert E-flat trio with some colleagues. So that's all great fun. And I'm planning some recital activity for the following season. So
yeah,
keeping going is important. I want to have projects.
Yeah.
If I'm not practicing something interesting and slightly challenging, I'm probably going to start to. So one still has to go into the room and play your scales and arpeggios and all your warm-ups and your studies and keep going. But that's fine. But I do love performing. So I'm lucky to have colleagues here I can perform with too.
Yeah. How long did you play in the piano trio for?
That was an 8-year run with that trio, the New Arts Trio.
Okay.
We did a USIS tour all over the place. And that was a pretty intense experience. That was my doctoral degree in music making, trying to figure out how to also this socially, it's tricky when you're in a really intense small chamber group, figuring out how to balance, juggle the individuals and stuff. I had a couple other trios after that that were maybe 3-4 year duration. And I spent also 7 years with the Los Angeles Piano Quartet.
Mm-hmm.
And that just really disbanded about 5 years ago, pre-COVID.
Okay.
But that was lovely. And of course, that's wonderful repertoire.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how you balance it all, but I guess having the collaborative teaching model, that probably helps you balance some of that too, I imagine.
Sure. Yeah. Well, because my wife is also very active in chamber music and is planning and performing in Ithaca with the Cayuga Chamber Orchestra, and they have their own chamber series.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of that going on. So some weeks she's doing that and I'm more here, and then some weeks I might be out. So we can spell each other a bit.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else that we might have missed you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, I'm just thinking about playing the cello. And if you're doing it and it's a passion, then keep going. It's hard in this day and age because there are so many concerns out there. I think for young people, it's particularly challenging. You can start to think you're in an ivory tower. And what connection does this have to the rest of life? And then you meet people that really have had a transformative experience in a concert and that who it really meant something to, and you realize, okay, this isn't for nothing that we're doing this.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty important to also to interact with people that have been involved in a performance you've been playing, or even just interacting with colleagues in a preparation for a performance.
Mm-hmm.
We have a joke about playing a concert that the concert is how you pay for all the fun of rehearsing for it. You know, oh gosh, now we have to perform this. And actually, the concert's a thrill, but it's also, everybody's a little nervous for a concert. But the process of preparation, the process of getting the music ready is kind of magical.
Yeah. I don't know if I would say that about an orchestra career. I might say the opposite.
That the concert's the reward.
Yes, exactly. For lots of rehearsals.
Yes, it's true. Well, the concert is a reward, but we have a joke that way. Sorry, you can leave that out if you want.
No, it's funny. And I think it's definitely different in chamber music. That collaborative work is very different than when you're sitting in an orchestra and one person is telling you that this is how it needs to be. So it's not this, you're just looking forward to the freedom of playing a concert and putting the work of doing what the conductor wants out there for the audiences where it can be quite satisfying. So it's a very different experience, but I always say, and we talk about it so much on this podcast, that playing chamber music is really the best way to become a great orchestral player, because you need all the skills that you get from chamber music to sit in an orchestra.
You do. And with luck, you're playing across the group. You're listening and responding to the winds and to the people on the other side of the stage. One of the things I missed the most leaving the Rochester Philharmonic was I really missed the bass section.
Yeah.
I felt that amazing foundation behind me.
Yeah.
And oh my God, I missed that. It's like going without chocolate. I had to quit though, because I had so many other engagements that I couldn't stay within the contract.
Oh yeah.
So I was scuppered. But the repertoire and the music is really extraordinary.
Yeah.
And that can be very rewarding. I think the best career is going to have a balance of as many different, I keep talking to the students about having as many musical threads in your life as you can, because it's also possibly different income streams. If you're doing some orchestral playing, if you're teaching, and if you're playing chamber music, and if you're working on your solo rep, you can stay alive in all different areas, all different ways.
Yeah. And it gives you the variety, I think, that we all crave and need in our lives.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that's possibly for me most rewarding in the teaching area is the human interaction and watching somebody gradually attaining their potential or realizing their potential, and also watching somebody's confidence kind of gradually taking hold.
Yeah.
And watching them start to fly. That's a big thrill.
Yeah, I bet. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
It's an honor.
Thank you so much to Stephen Doan for joining us today and sharing his story with us. And thank you for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. For more information on Stephen and any of the links we spoke about today, check out our show notes by scrolling down on the episode. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview cellist Justin Goldsmith, who is a member of the Euclid String Quartet in residence at Indiana University's South Bend. Justin gives us an inside look as to what it's like making your career as a member of a quartet. We're here to serve you, so if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like us to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was edited by Eric Begay at Red House Productions and produced and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.